sun, because in fact it is dangerous for some of us. So if you see anybody walking around with full sleeves and an umbrella, don't assume they're crazy. Just know they cannot be in the sun. And that's an amazing... I've had people come up and, why do you have an umbrella and your sleeves are down? Are you cold? I'm going, okay. All right. So let's be sensible and loving and kind. All right. Contact us. And thank you so much, Kate, for being our engineer today. And we will see you next month, fourth Monday of every month, Disability Awareness.
KBOO Monday, April 27th through Friday, May 2nd from noon to 4, and Saturday and Sunday, May 2nd and 3rd from noon to 5 p.m. to hear our live broadcast from the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, brought to you by our friends and colleagues at WWOZ in New Orleans. We'll have access to five stages of fantastic traditional and contemporary New Orleans jazz and blues, brass bands, and interviews and commentary by the best that WWOZ has to offer. That's the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, starting Monday, April 27th. The weekdays, we'll broadcast it from noon to 4 p.m., and Saturday and Sunday, May 2nd and 3rd, we'll broadcast the festival from noon to 5 p.m., here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
This is KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Welcome to the Radio Zine. I'm Kathleen Stevenson, and my guest is Lisa Shannon. Lisa is a human rights activist, writer, and speaker. She is also a Portlander. She is best known as the founder of Run for Congo Women, and she has spearheaded multiple media and human rights campaigns for Congo and Somalia. Lisa, welcome. Welcome to KBOO.
Thanks so much for having me.
Actually, welcome back to KBOO, because you have been here before. You talked about, in the past, maybe A Thousand Sisters, a book that you wrote before. Your new book is Mama Coco and the 100 Gunmen, an ordinary family's extraordinary tale of love, loss, and survival in Congo. Mama Coco and the 100 Gunmen is the story of the voyage Lisa took with her friend, Congolese expatriate Francisca Thelen, to Francisca's beloved homeland, Congo, which is under the shadow of the militia known as Joseph Kony's Lord's Resistance Army. And Lisa will be discussing this book tonight at Powell City of Books on Burnside. That's at 7:30, and her friend Francisca Thelen will be with her in an audience discussion. So, Lisa, I mentioned in 2005 you founded the Run for Congo Women, a global run-walk movement benefiting women for Women International Congo's program. Just to give us some background, tell us a little bit about that project and how it came to be.
Sure. Well, you know, I had no exposure to Congo. I'd never been to Africa. I didn't know there was a war happening there. This was about 10 years ago, 2005, when I saw an episode of Oprah, a 20-minute segment on Oprah talking about what was happening for women there. And I was just shocked. You know, deadliest war since World War II. 5.4 million people had died in the conflict, a rape pandemic that is widely considered the worst on earth. So really humanitarian catastrophe. And yet at the time, no one was talking about it. I mean, you'd look for press in the U.S. covering this, and it was just absolutely absent. And I felt like I wanted to do something, and what I could think of at the time was a run in Forest Park here. I decided to run the entire length of Wildwood Trail on my own, mostly because I like asked friends, like, hey, maybe we should get together and do like a little fundraising party or whatever, and no one had heard of Congo, and nobody knew what was happening there, so I realized I was going to have to do something kind of extreme, so I decided on that 30-mile trail run, which for me was quite extreme at the time, you know, it grew from there, and I think, you know, I really think it was partly because it happened in Portland, and people were just so receptive and absolutely cared once they knew. The Oregonian ran a story in the living section, and checks started coming in, and I had set out to raise about $10,000, but actually raised $28,000 that first year for women. And today, Run for Congo Women, which, you know, has spread, and people do Run for Congo Women events, you know, that are as small as two people and as many as, you know, 700. We've raised more than $15 million for women through Women for Women International, and we've supported more than 90,000 Congolese women and kids. So really just a huge success, and something also, you know, that I'm quite proud to hear from people who started out, you know, doing a Run for Congo Women or sponsoring, who heard about what happened, and then they went out and created their own projects for Congo, totally on their own terms. So there's been a lot of movement around Congo in the last 10 years that's been very exciting and inspiring. But that's how I got into this. And, you know, this book, Mama Coco and the 100 Gunmen, started because Francisca was a Run for Congo Women volunteer in Portland. So I was introduced to her by someone who had read the story in the Oregonian, and we realized we were neighbors, and she invited me over for tea and started showing me all these amazing photo albums from home, and talking a lot about what she called the real Congo. You know, beautiful photos of gardens and people with fish the size of small children, and, you know, harvest festivals, and just a totally different world than anything I had heard about Congo. And she used to try to convince me, oh, you should come with me sometime. But I was so focused on Congo, the sort of red hot emergency, that I didn't have a lot of interest in that particular area, because where she was from was safe at the time. It was very stable. She was just helping with Run for Congo Women because she wanted to help other Congolese women. It was only later that she started getting calls from home.
And how did she come to Portland?
She married an American Peace Corps volunteer. So Kevin Thielen was a U of O grad who was wanting something other than the corporate life and decided to join the Peace Corps. He went over there, and quite a funny meeting story. She was assigned to be the welcome committee, and he got out of the car, and he had this long hair, and she blurted out, "Bonjour, mademoiselle." And he's like, "I'm a man." So they fell in love, and he lived there for 7 years. It's funny, she talks about how she was never really attracted to white men at all, because typically they were the sort of, in Congo, they would always, you know, just sit in their offices and sort of order people around. But Kevin was the sort of person who would get in a trench and work alongside his guys. She'd offer him lunch, and he'd be like, "Why would I eat when they can't eat lunch? I'm not going to do that." And so she just really respected him, and they developed quite a beautiful relationship. They wanted to live in Africa long term. His first job after the Peace Corps was actually in Rwanda in 1994, and the genocide happened within the same day that their cargo container with all of their things arrived. The genocide began, so they got out and ended up ultimately taking a family vote on whether they should move to the U.S., stay here, or stay in Africa. And Kevin was the only vote to stay. So that's how Francisca ended up here.
And there's a lot of history in some of the things that you've just said. Yeah. For instance, you mentioned that the area of Congo that she was from was safe at the time you met her, and the area that you had been working on, the area that the run was organized around, was not safe. So can you talk about how international events and people have influenced how safe Congo and different parts of Congo are?
Absolutely. So the crisis in Congo really began with the conclusion of the Rwandan genocide, where Hutu militias responsible for that genocide were pushed over the border into Congo. They basically melded into refugee camps and were ruling these camps. And the international community had a choice at that point, to either deal with them. It was suggested for a few $100 million they could just move those camps away from the border, but people deemed that too expensive at the time. So ultimately, Rwanda invaded, then other militias were formed to fight them and each other, and it erupted into what's been termed Africa's World War. So that's why a lot of the conflict has happened right on that border with Uganda and Rwanda. So that was really the epicenter of a lot of the conflict. In the north, Francisca is from an area that's right on the border of Sudan and Uganda. And so at the time it had been pretty stable, but the Lord's Resistance Army, who had been ruling northern Uganda, was pushed out into Congo. They moved into the Garamba National Park in 2006, and they laid low for about a year and a half. And then overnight, they started attacking, and Francisca's family coffee plantation that she spent her summers working on as a child sat right next to the park. So overnight, many of her cousins were killed, uncles attacked, nieces and nephews abducted, and that just began this year of phone calls. You know, her sitting at her dining room table at 1 a.m, just calling, trying to get through, dialing, you know, being disconnected. Once she called and someone picked up and she just was like, is everyone okay? And heard gunshots and the line went dead. I mean, just terrifying for her for like a year. And, you know, for us as the Run for Congo Women organizing team in Portland, we wanted to support her. We went in and met with, you know, our senators' staff to talk with them about what could be done. But I think, you know, I think she just felt really overwhelmed and quite helpless from here. You know this is happening to your family and wanted to go back. And so that's how a lot of the conversation started about us traveling there together.
Right. And so that the year that you met her when Congo was still safe was?
It was 2005 that I met Francisca. Now, at that time, the Kivus were not safe. That's what I was organizing around. 2006, Kony moved in. 2008, the attacks began.
And
What I was going to say briefly is just that I think there is a connection between the two, though. And I think that has to do with the failure of the Congolese state. You have a government that has very little interest in the security of people. So, for instance, with the rape pandemic in Congo, it's mostly government soldiers who are attacking women. So there's a culture of impunity that's spread. I mean, you know, when we were there, we talked with people who actually saw the Congolese army block thousands of people trying to escape an LRA attack that was happening less than a mile away. And it's very dangerous. You know, you think about the differences and similarities between those two situations, the Kivus and what's happening in this Dungu area, Oriental province. With the common thread being the failed Congolese government, even though the LRA has been laying low of late, the potential for that to eventually erupt and become yet another situation like the Kivus, where it's gone on for, you know, 15, 20 years and really devolve into a very extreme situation beyond even just the militia violence that's happening, is very pronounced and a cause of great concern.
So. And talk for a minute, just a little bit more about Kony. You mentioned Kony, mm-hmm. and the LRA, what they are, and a little bit more about how they came into Congo and what happened.
So they are a group that formed in the late 80s in northern Uganda. And Kony is a religious cult figure. He is some cross between the traditional sort of belief system and then witchcraft practices and then Christian belief. So his objective was basically to take over Uganda and rule based on the Ten Commandments. But in the process, because he did not get a lot of ideological followers, they started abducting children to be soldiers. And so that is how he's maintained a presence and a force, by forcing kids to do really horrible things to their families and to other people so that they then feel like they can't leave. And so, you know, that was a major issue in northern Uganda for many years, you know, kids walking miles every night to escape being abducted. Eventually, as I said, you know, they were chased out into Congo and have engaged. Now they have spread up through the Central African Republic and Sudan. So Kony, people believe that Kony is in Sudan, in a little pocket of Sudan, and the Sudanese government has not been supportive of the folks who are going after him, trying to arrest him there. So that is a huge problem. Yeah, so, you know, Kony, I think the situation, because Kony is sort of a religious figure, often with these militias, you think, well, you get one guy, just another is going to pop up. And that might be true with his sons, but this is a situation where if Kony was captured and taken to the International Criminal Court, it has a very, very strong likelihood of making this violence go away altogether, because he has been sort of the madman behind the whole thing. That's not necessarily true with other militias, but in this case, getting Kony is highly significant. And if you talk with people on the ground there, they'll say, you know, you ask, what is it that you want? What would you want people around the world to know? And they would always say, get rid of the LRA, get Kony. So they're very pointed about that. You know, he is really the source of the problem here.
I'm speaking with Lisa Shannon. She is a Portlander. She is the person who originated the run for Congo Women, and she is the author of a new book, Mama Coco and the 100 Gunmen, An Ordinary Family's Extraordinary Tale of Love, Loss, and Survival in Congo. She will be at Powell's Books on Burnside tonight at 7:30, and there will be a discussion of this. Along with her will be her friend Francisca Thielen, who she has mentioned. And getting back to Francisca and the journey that you took, Lisa, tell us a little bit more about what happened once you and Francisca decided to make the journey and then actually did go to Congo.
Well, we had decided to go and actually just, we were meant to stay in Dungu and at her mother, Mama Coco's place. And just before we were supposed to leave, there was actually an attack in town in Dungu, where the LRA walked past the United Nations, past Congolese army, and attacked and killed a bunch of people in town less than a mile from Mama Coco's. And so it was quite a dangerous time to be there. They were spotted in town quite often when we were there, sort of on the cusp of town. So things were very unstable at the time. But, you know, we went for a couple of reasons. One, we really wanted to find out what had happened to her family. Obviously, she wanted to be there and have a chance to be with them. But for me, it was also about kind of looking for that real Congo that's behind a lot of those stories. You know, when I had gone to Congo previously, as I wrote about in 1,000 Sisters, I asked people all about how they were affected by the war, affected by militia violence, but I very rarely asked who they were outside of that violence. And I think that's something that haunted me when I came home. I realized there were a lot of questions I just wasn't asking, and that I was missing huge pieces of what Congo is. And so for me, it was also about asking a lot of questions about who these people are, who this family is outside of the conflict. What were their lives like? What is this violence in the context of their lives, as opposed to looking at them through a lens that almost seems to echo a lot of the stereotypes that people have about, you know, Africa, militia violence, you know, suffering, pain, whatever, that sort of thing just happens there. Whereas for them, that's not what their lives have been like at all, you know. So looking at it through a very different lens, that was part of the objective. Once we were there, you know, we had a chance to have a lot of conversations with her family about many things, including the violence. And I think, you know, we set out wanting to collect those stories, and I think it was harder for Francisca than she was thinking it would be. You know, I think that there was a piece of her that didn't want the Congo and home that she knew sort of taken away by learning everything that had happened to them, you know, just in the last few years. So I think that was sort of a struggle. But the family, I mean, getting to know the family, they are really just lovely people. And, you know, I think Francisca learned quite a bit about her family, too. I mean, I remember sitting down with Mama Coco and asking her, you know, to tell us a little bit about her childhood. And the first thing she said was, well, I was married as an infant. And Francisca was like, what? I didn't know this. Apparently, she had been betrothed. And when she was 12, some old guy shows up at school claiming to be her husband. She really pitched a fit and managed to get out of it. And then a few years delay all these marriage proposals because she was quite a beautiful young woman. And her husband-to-be eventually came around and she was, you know, her parents told her she had to marry this guy. And so the first month they spent together, she was plotting to escape. But they actually fell in love because he wasn't mean. He would teach her how to, like, cook and sweep, and he was very kind, and they fell in love. So,
and talk about her today and mm-hmm. how you experienced her in the telling of these stories that you that she related to you.
Mama Coco is a very quiet, very reserved, extremely dignified woman. She is unquestionably the family matriarch, and just really understated. She's not really a talker. So it took a lot to get her to kind of open up. And she did more talking with Francisca on their own as well. I think she would say things like, "I don't understand why I've lost so many people." You know, when the violence started, her kids had left town to go gather some crops for the family, and she was watching all of the children in the family. And they had no notice, so they had to gather everything and just head out of town. So here she is, like 60-something, hauling like something like 6 grandchildren, many of them under the age of 5, by herself with, you know, the help of 1 or 2 teenagers from the family. And she collapsed on the road. She had been walking for days and collapsed on the road because she was just so tired. What I found remarkable about her and about a lot of people that I spoke with there was how focused they stayed on community despite everything that was happening. You know, when she first saw relatives who had lost everyone, who had really lived through massacres, you know, all she could say is, we'll stick together, we're in it together. And I think that's the feeling that you get there, that despite all this horrific stuff that's happened, that people will stick together. I mean, and when you, like, there was one guy I interviewed when I asked him about an attack. He was telling me that story, and he went out with 10 people to collect crops, and they ran into the LRA, and everyone ran, but they all ran back to the meeting place so they wouldn't leave each other there. And I was like, why didn't you just run for your life? Like, why would you go back? And he said, well, you don't just, they're my neighbors, they're like my family, you don't just leave people. To them, it was just the most foreign concept that you would ever just leave someone to suffer that way. And so in that way, I think in very simple ways, very understated ways, they have a value system that I think we probably could learn quite a lot from.
And there is one story in the book that, or at least it's related when, or maybe it's not in the book, but it's a story that you tell in an article that I read, where the husband of a woman who was under fire did leave, got on his bicycle and left.
Yes,
and that was she was left to try to survive, and it's quite a tragic story, I guess I should mention.
Yeah, so this is actually the massacre that happened right before we arrived in Dungu. So this happened in town. It was Francisca's cousin. Her husband, she lived on the cusp of town, and she and her husband apparently had been talking about breaking up, but I don't know. But when the attack started, he took his 4-year-old son and pushed his 4-year-old son toward the militia, got on a bike, and rode to safety himself and left her there. She grabbed her baby and was running. She was shot and fell and climbed over into the grass trying to hide from the LRA. And she died that night. She bled to death. And in the morning, they found her baby nursing, still nursing from her dead body. And this was Francisca's cousin that this happened to. I got to know those kids. I went to the hospital to visit that baby because he was having a really rough time. I didn't know the background about the dad at first, but learned it. And I was like, okay, he just seems so limp. And I just wanted to try to find a way to connect and kind of love him back to life, help him get a little spark back. And so I would borrow him for long afternoons and show him videos of, like, on my cell phone of, like, birds in my backyard or my cats or whatever. And we got to be quite close friends. And, I thought about adopting him, but I, just as an activist, was not in a position to do that. A couple of years later, he died. The baby died, and that has been something that has been really hard for me. You know, I've obviously done everything I know how to do for people in Congo. I've blown up my life to make that happen, but I think that is one regret that I really carry. As for his brothers, who have lived, the one brother who was pushed toward the militia and the elder, Francisca just went back. And my mom went with her because they're working on a project called Friends of Minzoto to support the Minzoto.org is that organization to support them rebuilding there. So my mom went with her. They've been working on this project, and they went and tracked down his brothers. Mm-hmm. And the brother who had been pushed toward the militia had been living with him, and apparently it was a very abusive situation. But they have made arrangements for both of those kids to live with their aunt instead, and so they're being supported going to school, and we've been able to sort of intervene there in a way that, you know, feels good after what happened with Arete.
Lisa, we just have a few minutes left, and I know it's a huge question, but talk a little bit about what you think should happen as far as U.S. policy towards Congo and issues related on that level.
Absolutely. Couple of things. One, elections. You know, the international community really supported elections in 2006, and that was a huge success. We let Kabila steal the election in 2011, and that is a very, very dangerous message to send to the Congolese government, that they are not responsible to the Congolese people. So 2016... President Kabila is supposed to leave office, and he needs to go. It's constitutionally mandated. And so international support led by the U.S. To fund free and fair elections is enormously important for many, many reasons. Secondly, with in the case of Dungu, funding rebuilding is very important. You know, you have militias other than the LRA now passing through there, and a lot of kids who have left the LRA, but they're really traumatized. They haven't gotten the proper support. So this is a moment where, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Like, we could spend billions down the road like we have in the Kivus, or we could really help Dungu get back on track. And so allocating right now, I think the ask is for $10 million, an additional $10 million to help the Dungu area rebuild. And that's something we could all let our representatives know we really support, allocating those funds. You know, and beyond that, I think, you know, making sure that the U.S. Special Envoy, there's been a transition there, that they are really just holding the government of Congo accountable, and also the government of Rwanda, who've been known for backing a lot of atrocities in Congo. So those are the primary things. I think above all, elections, because everything else kind of springs from that. And we need to be pretty rigorous about that. And then coordinating our own policy. There have been times we've given $1 billion a year to Congo with no coordination between all the different departments. And that, to me, is just ridiculous. Like, there needs to be a cohesive policy.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming into KBOO and talking about this, and let people know again that your new book is called Mama Coco and the 100 Gunmen, and that's an Ordinary Families, Extraordinary Tale of Love, Loss, and Survival in Congo. And you will be speaking about it tonight. You said it's going to be more like a discussion than a
Francisca and I are going to, I'm going to mostly interview Francisca and really give her a chance to talk. And then people will be able to ask her questions. And it's actually the only opportunity to get both Francisca and I to sign books. So if people want a book that's signed by both of us, tonight's the night to do it. And it's also our only public appearance together for the book release. So it's a really unique opportunity to hear really directly from her what this has been like.
And that's at Powell's on Burnside. That's tonight at 7:30. Thanks again for coming in, Lisa. And I hope your event goes really well.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Kathleen Stevenson for the Radio Zine. If you have any desire to hear this interview again or miss part of it, it will be available on our website, kboo.fm, in a little in the next hour. And thanks, Kate, for engineering. And stay tuned for the noon news.
KBOO Monday, April 27th through Friday, May 2nd from noon to 4, and Saturday and Sunday, May 2nd and 3rd from noon to 5 p.m. to hear our live broadcast from the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, brought to you by our friends and colleagues at WWOZ in New Orleans. We'll have access to 5 stages of fantastic traditional and contemporary New Orleans jazz and blues, brass bands, and interviews and commentary by the best that WWOZ has to offer. That's the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, starting Monday, April 27th. The weekdays, we'll broadcast it from noon to 4 p.m., and Saturday and Sunday, May 2nd and 3rd, we'll broadcast the festival from noon to 5 p.m., here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.